KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. The president aims to cut the staff at the Social Security Administration. What does that mean for people who rely on those payments? We put that question to a former Social Security commissioner on Morning Edition from NPR News. Coming up, we'll listen to China's reply to the Trump administration. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Steve Inskeep reporting from Beijing. One of China's top officials asserts that his country is now the one that follows global rules. The Supreme Court considers voting rights in a case where the U.S. government changed its opinion. And we visit Montana, where birds fill the sky on their way to the Arctic. It's Monday, March 24th, the birthday of three athletes. Chris Bosh is 41. Peyton Manning is 49. Golfer Pat Bradley is 74. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Trump says that any country that buys oil or gas from Venezuela will now have to pay a 25% tariff to the United States. Writing online, Trump called this a secondary tariff on Venezuela. He alleged without evidence Venezuela is sending tens of thousands of criminals to the U.S. Trump says the tariff will happen April 2nd. That's the day he is vowing to impose widespread tariffs on all other nations. This afternoon, a federal appeals court will take up President Trump's appeal to block a lower court judge's orders to release information about recent deportation flights. U.S. District Judge James Boasberg wants to know why Trump used a wartime power to deport hundreds of migrants when the U.S. is not at war. The power is known as the Alien Enemies Act. President Trump's border czar, Tom Homan, says the administration won't defy the judge's order but will continue to deport migrants.
I don't care what that judge thinks. As far as this case, we're going to continue to arrest public safety threats and national security threats. We're going to continue to deport them from the United States. I understand this case is in litigation through the Alien Enemies Act, and we'll abide by the court order as litigated.
He spoke to ABC News this week. A federal judge has blocked members of the cost-cutting entity DOGE from getting access to some personal data at three federal agencies. NPR's Stephen Fowler has more.
A coalition of labor unions sued the Treasury Department, the Office of Personnel Management, and the Education Department over sweeping access to sensitive data given to DOGE employees. A federal judge in Maryland ruled Monday that the three agencies likely violated a federal privacy law and the Administrative Procedure Act by giving the DOGE affiliates access to personal information that they, quote, had no need to know. This preliminary injunction prevents the disclosure of data of the union members in the lawsuit. A different judge last week issued a temporary restraining order blocking all DOGE-related access to Social Security Administration data. Stephen Fowler, NPR News, Atlanta.
U.S. negotiators are holding another round of talks with Russian officials today in Saudi Arabia. The meetings come as the Trump administration continues to pursue a ceasefire, as NPR's Charles Maines reports from Moscow.
In effect, the U.S. hopes to expand on a 30-day pause on attacks on energy infrastructure that President Trump negotiated with the leaders of Russia and Ukraine in phone calls last week. Even as Moscow and Kyiv have accused one another of violating that agreement, the White House says it now seeks a similar maritime ceasefire in the Black Sea to allow free flow of shipping. Meanwhile, President Trump's stated goal of a full ceasefire continues to bump up against Russian demands. Going into the talks, the Kremlin's chief negotiator said any wider peace hinged on the West ending all military aid to Ukraine and Kyiv demobilizing its forces. Moves Ukraine and its allies say is akin to surrender. Charles Maines, NPR News, Moscow.
You're listening to NPR News. NPR has learned that Israel is considering a major ground invasion into Gaza. The intent is to fully occupy the Palestinian enclave and establish Israeli military rule. The effort could possibly begin in a few months. However, NPR has learned it is not clear if the plan would ever be carried out or when it might start. The University of Connecticut will not be repeating as champions of the NCAA men's basketball tournament this year. As Greg Ecklin reports, UConn lost to top-seeded Florida yesterday as the Gators moved on to the tournament's Sweet 16.
To reach the Sweet 16, UConn would have to knock off a number one seed, the University of Florida, but the Gators prevailed 77-75 And UConn Huskies coach Dan Hurley says he'll be going through what he calls rewiring in the upcoming offseason.
Just get caught up in this tidal wave of success that we've had. You lose perspective.
With Florida moving on to the Sweet 16, the Gators are one of seven SEC teams still alive. The women's defending champion is the University of South Carolina, which advanced to the Sweet 16 after a 64-53 win over Indiana University. For NPR News, I'm Greg Eklund.
The genetic testing firm 23andMe says it has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. The CEO has stepped down. The company is trying to bring about a sale as well. 23andMe says that it will continue to operate during a sale process. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at lemelson.org. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Beijing, China.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. In a few minutes, we will hear from a former Social Security commissioner about how Trump's proposed cuts to the agency could affect beneficiaries. But first, we have new details about military plans Israel has drawn up for Gaza.
Israel is considering a ground invasion to fully occupy the territory within a few months and establish Israeli military rule over Palestinians there. It's unclear whether these plans will actually be carried out. We do know that Israel resumed its war in Gaza, where Palestinians have updated their death count, saying it surpassed 50,000.
NPR's Daniel Estrin is on the line with us now from Tel Aviv. Daniel, good morning.
Good morning, Michelle.
What can you tell us about these classified plans?
Well, I've spoken to two people who they reviewed the classified plans, and they spoke to me on condition of anonymity to discuss them. The plans would have Israeli forces occupy Gaza, entering at multiple points, pushing Palestinians into a small zone designated for civilians, and that Israel is examining options for the military to control the distribution of food, which would be limited to a minimum caloric amount. Now, both people who reviewed these plans said it's unclear if they would really be carried out or if they're just a negotiation tactic to pressure Hamas to release more hostages. In fact, it might be both, getting some hostages free from Hamas captivity initially, but then gradually moving toward full military rule over Palestinians in Gaza, which would go far beyond what Israel has stated as its war goals. The military told me it would not comment on future operational plans.
Do these plans for Israel ruling Gaza have the support of the Trump administration?
We don't know. Trump administration officials did not return my requests for comment. We do know that Secretary of State Marco Rubio and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu discussed Israel's military operations in Gaza yesterday. We also know that President Trump's Mideast envoy, Steve Witkoff, has acknowledged that Bibi Netanyahu's return to war is not what many Israelis want. He talked about that in a podcast interview with commentator Tucker Carlson, published Friday.
I think Bibi feels that he's doing the right thing. I think he goes up against public opinion because public opinion there wants those hostages home.
And indeed, there have been daily protests in the streets here saying the return to war only benefits Netanyahu's right-wing coalition and endangers hostages in Gaza.
To that end, what are you hearing from Israelis about these plans for Gaza?
Some are seeing this as something that should have been done already and that can actually lead to the defeat of Hamas. We spoke with Amir Avivi, who's a former deputy commander of the military's Gaza division.
You cannot destroy Hamas without controlling the entire Gaza Strip. Eventually, you'll have to control everything. Bringing a collapse of Hamas as a governmental and military entity, this can be achieved in a few months.
So he's saying a few months, but other Israeli defense officials and analysts who I spoke with are more skeptical about that. Also, Dan Shapiro, a top Pentagon official on Mideast policy under the Biden administration, spoke with us. They're saying, okay, well, once Israel occupies Gaza, then what? This could mire Israeli soldiers in Gaza for decades, and we're hearing from reservist soldiers already. They're exhausted after more than a year of war and very skeptical that this could actually change the picture fundamentally.
That is NPR's Daniel Estrin in Tel Aviv. Daniel, thank you.
You're welcome.
The Trump administration says big changes are coming to Social Security. The agency that distributes benefits to more than 70 million people may see cuts to staff and field offices closed. And recipients could encounter tougher identity checks as Elon Musk, the president's close advisor and largest donor, claims Social Security is rife with fraud. A spokesperson for Social Security told NPR it is focused on, quote, identifying efficiencies and reducing costs, unquote. But others who follow the agency say it is already underfunded and they dispute allegations of widespread fraud. We wanted to ask somebody who knows how the agency functions, so we called Michael Astrew. He led Social Security for 6 years under Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama, and he's with us now. Good morning, Mr. Astrew.
Good morning. Nice to be back.
Good to have you. So based on your experience, is the Social Security Administration rife with fraud? Elon Musk keeps insisting that it is.
No, it's not. And the big claims are just flat out wrong, and the $2.5 billion being paid to people over the age of 100 is just simply not true. The agency's been very careful with that. It's been audited by the IG and the GAO. There are about 50,000 people getting those benefits, and there are more that are that age that are not getting benefits. So it's a product of the fact that they sent in a group of 20-year-olds with laptops who are used to seeing certain types of code. They went in without the proper authorities to what we call the Numidin and didn't understand it.
They didn't understand what they were seeing.
No.
And they drew a conclusion based on their own lack of understanding of how the agencies actually works.
And you can't fault them for that because they haven't ever seen COBOL code before. But you can fault Elon Musk because instead of admitting error, he doubled down and had the President of the United States make that claim, and that's a real disservice to President Trump.
Are you concerned that these proposed changes, like requiring people to verify their identities in person, could cause people to lose benefits that they actually should get?
Yes, it's at least going to cause delays, and in some cases they may just not get it at all. And to put in this requirement at the same time that you're cutting back staff and office space dramatically is going to compound what is already a big problem. I mean, for 9 of the last 12 years, the agency has not had a confirmed commissioner. Things have gone backwards in terms of service delivery. There are a lot of things that need to do to bring it back to the way that it should be. Now, instead, we've got these massive layoffs. We've got these orders to do things to cut down on fraud where they don't understand the system, they don't understand the consequences, and it's making it worse. And they're going to drive a lot of people who are doing very efficient phone calls to switch, for instance, bank accounts for direct deposit, force them all into offices where there are already enormous lines and you can't get through the 800 number to make an appointment to get in. So these people are going to get long delays in getting paid and, you know, they may suffer. I mean, I went to my local office 10 days ago, freezing cold. I waited in the car, but there was a line of, I don't know, about 15 people out there in 20-degree weather, just waiting to get in the hope that they'd be able to see someone.
Where would you look for efficiencies and cost reductions if you were still in charge?
Well, the back office operations, a lot of the more arcane thing, is very labor intensive. It's very slow, and it's fairly error prone. So a lot of that could be done with artificial intelligence. You're also running, the agency also runs the largest system of justice in the world. And under agency rules now, most people are submitting medical records of 500 to 1,000 pages. So for the judges and the staff to get through those is hard. Now, we tried to automate that on my watch, and the technology wasn't ready. I think the technology is ready now, and I think if they could do that well, it would be efficient and it would be a better service for the public.
So tomorrow, the Senate Finance Committee will question Trump's nominee to lead Social Security. His name is Frank Bisignano. He is the CEO of Fiserv, that's a financial tech company. He says he's, quote, fundamentally a Doge person. And I take that to mean that he aligns himself with Elon Musk's push to remake the government. But what are you looking for from the new commissioner?
Well, I think we need a perspective other than the Doge perspective. I mean, I'm all for cutting waste. I'm all for efficiencies. And if you look back at the productivity increases in my 6 years, they were substantial. They were well above anything before or since. And we use those to reduce the disability backlog. If you want to go in and put in efficiencies to bring down the size of the agency, you can do that. But there's a smart way to do it, and there's a stupid way to do it. And we're doing it the way that 22-year-old frat boys that have never seen this system think is a good idea, and that's a mistake.
Okay. Simple words there. That is, yeah, Michael Astrew. He's a former commissioner of Social Security. He served under Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama. Mr. Astrew, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
In case you haven't heard, spring is here.
The trees are budding. The birds are singing. What a perfect time to stay inside your house and do some spring cleaning.
Because there's dust to bust. And we have some spring cleaning tips from Keyshawn Lane, who posts home maintenance tips on the website weeklyhomecheck.com. He suggests starting with the fridge.
A lot of the times we're afraid to see what's behind our fridge, right? Because it's such a like an uninhabited area. This is an appliance that is not cheap. And so we want to make sure we get the lifespan out of it. So this does require a little bit of heavy lifting, if you will, if you can move your appliance back and really vacuum out those coils.
Because cleaning back there is not only weirdly satisfying, it also prevents fire. Dirty coils become a fire hazard when they get clogged with dirt, dust, and pet hair. And dirty coils can raise your energy costs.
After you've done that, you can move on to your HVAC filter.
Air filters, it should be replaced every 1 to 3 months, especially if you suffer from allergies as we're going into the springtime and pollen is starting to get up in the air.
And you might not realize that there is a filter in your dishwasher too.
Food can get stuck into the filters, which can really impact its ability to clean, can impact its ability to dry. Also, this is a water appliance, right? So you want to make sure that there's no mold or there's no mildew in any loose or cut wires or tubes in your dishwasher.
Lane recommends checking that filter every 1 to 3 months, which is about as often as he recommends cleaning out your drains.
Flush those with vinegar and baking soda, but the trick to this is, a lot of people forget this one part, you want to cover it after pouring the baking soda and then the vinegar, you want to cover it to trap the reaction. This will push through any gunk and debris that's sitting there in the pipe.
Okay, Steve, tell the truth. Did you go to Beijing to avoid cleaning your fridge?
Of course I did. I love his advice because he's talking about cleaning the things that are not visible. He's not scrubbing a wall or a floor. He's like, the things you can't see.
Get in there.
Out of sight, out of mind, are in his mind.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, legal scholar Elie Mystal talks about the 10 laws he says are ruining America. In his new book, Bad Law, he argues that our country's laws on immigration, abortion, and voting rights don't reflect the will of most Americans, and we'd be better off abolishing them and starting over. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Easy Cater, a business tool for food designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend at easycater.com. From Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool, customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. From Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The Supreme Court hears arguments today over voting rights in Louisiana. The case involves the way the state draws congressional district boundaries, and it concerns the Voting Rights Act, the 1965 law against racial discrimination in elections. This is one of the cases in which the Trump administration has changed the federal government's opinion. NPR's Hansi-Lo Wong reports.
In the first week of this Trump administration, the Justice Department told the Supreme Court it had changed its mind. In the lawsuit the court's hearing today, the DOJ no longer takes the position that to get in line with the Voting Rights Act, Louisiana needed to draw another congressional district where black voters have an opportunity to elect their preferred candidate.
What we are seeing now is the Department of Justice saying that they're not in the business of enforcing these voting rights statutes and laws.
Gilda Daniels is a former Justice Department official who served during the Clinton and George W. Bush administrations. Legal views often change with a new administration. Still, Daniel says in her experience, no matter who's the president, the DOJ seriously deliberates before moving forward with any case.
In the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division voting section, you don't just wake up one day and say, I'm going to bring a Section 2 Voting Rights Act case. So by the time you get to filing a case, you're pretty sure that there has been a violation of one of these voting rights statutes or the Constitution.
This month, the Justice Department dropped out of another case, this one over voting maps in Texas. Private groups are still suing. NPR reached out to the DOJ for comment, but has not heard back.
May it please the court, Noah Bocat-Lindell for the United States.
Justice Department attorneys like Noah Bocat-Lindell are still moving ahead with other voting rights cases like this one. It's over Georgia's redistricting plans, and it was argued before an appeals court in January, 3 days after President Trump's second inauguration.
The United States intervened in this case to defend the constitutionality of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, as well as to address the issues of racial causation and private enforcement.
While the DOJ has changed its position in some cases and so far maintained its position in others, voting rights advocates see another source of uncertainty. For decades, private individuals and groups have brought most of the lawsuits for enforcing Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. But Republican state officials have been bringing a novel legal argument that the law does not allow private individuals and groups to bring these lawsuits. Advocates fear it's another potential path for weakening one of the key remaining sections of the landmark law.
What we do is necessary, but is insufficient.
For now, civil rights leaders like Damon Hewitt of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law say their groups are trying to keep doing their part by helping to bring lawsuits and enforce the Voting Rights Act.
We need Congress to do its part, to give us the tools to advocate, to litigate, and frankly, to educate people on what our rights are, what our rights should be.
Hewitt says one of those tools would be restoring a key part of the Voting Rights Act that the Supreme Court dismantled in 2013. It required certain places with a history of racial discrimination to get pre-clearance from the Justice Department or a federal court before changing any election rules. The latest bill to restore that part of the law, though, is unlikely to pass in this Republican-controlled Congress. Hansi-Lo Wong, NPR News, Washington.
The sky above the town of Shodo, Montana, comes alive every spring. Huge flocks of migrating geese, swans, and other birds swoop in during their long migration to the Arctic from as far south as Mexico. Montana Public Radio's Ellis Julin takes us there.
It's before dawn.
and hundreds of people stand in reverent silence in the dark on the shores of Freezeout Lake. It's cold and a strong wind whips across the water. As the sun creeps along the horizon line, it throws pale hues of orange and pink. The squawking of birds fills the air. Lisa Hudnut, a retired local teacher, quickly sets up a spotting scope. Colors reflect off the white blur of tens of thousands of geese and swans, like a thin layer of snow on the water's surface.
Uh-oh.
Suddenly, following some signal known only to the geese, they begin to take flight. The white birds look like washed-out flamingos for just a moment, before the sunrise color extends onto the snow of the Rocky Mountain peaks in the distance. Cotton candy snow echoing the sherbet sky.
Look at that.
The flock undulates overhead, rising rapidly and growing quieter as it does, like a cloud coming to life. Hudnut, a devout birder, volunteers for this migration event every year, enthusiastically taking groups of people out to see the spectacle.
Does it ever get old?
No, it never gets old.
Yesterday, they counted over 30,000 geese. Smaller flocks of half a dozen or so tundra swans flank the geese, their own honking adding to the cacophony. Hudnut knows the best bird viewing spot because she's got a woman on the inside. It's her friend Nancy Molesky's job to count the birds every morning for the State Wildlife Agency.
Always a surprise how many are there. The birds move around quite a lot. We think we know what they have on their little bird minds, but no, the birds decide everything.
Molesky's counted the birds here at Freezeout Lake every year for over a decade. It sits on the high plains where they sweep up to meet the mountains, walls of stone rising into the clouds. In the other direction, prairie, what's called the Golden Triangle, rolling hills of wheat and barley as far as the eye can see. If you've had a beer from Coors or Anheuser-Busch, you've sampled some of this region's grains. The flocks come to feast on what's left over from last fall's harvest. At night, they sleep on the lake safe from predators. Maggie Carr, a local wilderness outfitter, volunteers to drive a van full of tourists following the birds around.
This is the one that's fun, the like road warriors, like, oh, like chasing him, like twister chasing.
But I want everyone to remember
bird chasing
that we scored here.
Yeah.
Okay.
Scored because we caught the amazing takeoff of the flocks at dawn. These women helped start the Wild Wings Festival in 2018. It's a labor of love, celebrating Shodo and the birds. Volunteers cycle through roles on the committee each year, and this year is Carr's turn as chair.
Festival has a really low barrier to entry. It doesn't matter your age or your physical ability. That's what makes it great.
In Montana, it's often said, sometimes as a jab, sometimes as a point of pride, that there are more cows than people. But for the next few weeks, it's the geese that will outnumber the human population, at least in this county. For NPR News, I'm Ellis Ju Lin.
This is NPR News.
For many, places of worship are also places to feel safe. They're a refuge. However, the Trump administration's hawkish stance on immigration has faith leaders and their congregations worried.
What are the plans if ICE does knock on the door right now?
Well, that's what I'm feverishly trying to figure out.
I'm Elsa Chang, how religious leaders are dealing with the threat of ICE raids on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Delegations from the United States and Ukraine have begun talks in Saudi Arabia to try to achieve a ceasefire in Russia's war with Ukraine. Ukraine's defense minister called the conversation productive. The U.S. holds talks next with Russia. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley has a reaction from Kyiv.
No one believes that Russian President Vladimir Putin really wants to stop the war. And frankly, the proof of that is all around them. On Saturday night, Russia launched one of its biggest drone attacks yet against Ukraine's capital, Kyiv. There were fires all night. 3 people were killed, says the mayor of Kyiv, and dozens wounded.
NPR's Eleanor Beardsley. Second Lady Usha Vance has announced plans to visit Greenland this week as President Trump has repeatedly talked about purchasing the island, a self-governing territory of Denmark. Denmark and Greenland have both said it is not for sale. Vance's office says she will be part of a U.S. delegation visiting historic sites and learning about the heritage. Here's Second Lady Usha Vance.
I'm also coming to celebrate the long history of mutual respect and cooperation between our nations, and to express hope that our relationship will only grow stronger in the coming years.
President Trump has announced that the U.S. will put a 25% tariff on trade with countries that buy Venezuelan oil starting April 2nd. That announcement being made on social media. The Dow is up 552 points, more than 1%. This is NPR News. The South African ambassador expelled by the U.S. has returned home from Washington. Kate Bartlett reports the ambassador said he had no regrets over his comments about the Trump administration.
Hundreds of dancing and singing trade union members greeted Ibrahim Rasool at the airport in Cape Town, despite South African President Cyril Ramaphosa cautioning against it. Secretary of State Marco Rubio declared Rasool persona non grata after he said in a lecture that MAGA was a supremacist response to growing diversity. There's been debate in South Africa as to whether the diplomat should have made the comments, but Rasool himself said he stood by them. He said South Africa must strive to restore relations with the U.S., but not at the expense of its values. For NPR News, I'm Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg.
French cinema star Gérard Depardieu is on trial in Paris for allegedly sexually assaulting 2 women on a movie set in 2021. The trial could be a pivotal moment in the Me Too movement in France. More than 20 women have accused Depardieu of sexually harassing or attacking them over the years. He has denied all the allegations. The 76-year-old actor may be best known around the world for his roles in films such as Life of Pi, The Man in the Iron Mask, and Cyrano de Bergerac, which earned him an Oscar nomination in 1991. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Beijing. We are reporting this week from China, which is trying to accelerate its economy amid a trade war with the United States. And we are lucky to have an observer with us who has seen decades of China's economic rise. NPR's Anthony Kuhn first saw this country in 1982, when it was just opening up to the world economy. And Anthony, I assume you were about, what, 4 or 5 years old at that point?
I was a college student, Steve.
Okay, college student. He lived here as China rose. He still lives nearby in Seoul, South Korea. He's back for a visit. And he's brought us a story that gets at the contradictions of capitalism under communism, which is my alliteration work for the day. Anthony, what's the story?
Well, it's about the Chinese government's efforts to reassure its entrepreneurs and tell them that they have a green light to invest, to start businesses, create jobs, and benefit society. But this is a message that we've heard many times over the course of decades, and it points to a fundamental tension between the state and private entrepreneurs. So to illustrate this, let me explain about what the government is doing now and then tell you about what happened in the past. Executives of China's top tech firms applauded as China's leader Xi Jinping and other top officials entered a huge meeting room in Beijing's Great Hall of the People. As the executives sat dutifully taking notes, Xi urged them to serve the country, focus on development, abide by the law, and those who get rich first should promote common prosperity, he said, to make new and greater contributions to advancing China's modernization. Xi did not tell the executives how to spread their wealth, but he reassured them of the government's support and protection. And that signals a significant policy shift, says Huang Yasheng, professor of global economics and management at MIT's Sloan School.
So I think the general background is the private sector has been operating under tremendous regulatory pressures and constraints in the last 3 or 4 years.
The most prominent example of China's clipping the wings of its high-flying tech CEOs was Jack Ma, co-founder of e-commerce giant Alibaba. Authorities launched an anti-monopoly investigation into Alibaba in 2020 and suspended the huge stock market listing of its financial arm, shortly after Ma made comments critical of China's financial regulators. Ma moved to Japan, where he kept a low profile. Then he resurfaced at last month's high-profile meeting in Beijing. And while state media reports did not mention Ma's name or quote any of his remarks, Huang says that just the image of Ma shaking hands with Xi Jinping was enough to signal that Ma had been rehabilitated. It was, Huang says,
not a direct message that the crackdown was reversed, but at least the message is that from now on, you're okay.
At least one other entrepreneur who fell afoul of the law hopes he'll be rehabilitated too. I met him for lunch at a restaurant in downtown Beijing. Gu Chujun was born in a rural area of East China 66 years ago and rose to become, according to Forbes magazine, one of China's richest entrepreneurs around the turn of the century. He built a business empire of dozens of companies, the crown jewel of which was an appliance maker called Kulan Electrical Holdings Company.
Local officials thought that I had run this company very well, and they wanted to take it away from me. They didn't negotiate or say, I want to buy your company. Instead, they tried to arrest me and forced me to sell it. And if I had refused, they would have just taken it.
Gu was arrested in 2005 and convicted of embezzlement and fraud, charges Gu says were trumped up. He was sentenced to 10 years in jail, but served only 7. In 2018, Xi Jinping met with business executives in an earlier bid to reassure entrepreneurs, and the following year, China's Supreme Court cleared Gu of 3 out of 4 charges. But they let one charge stand, Gu says, so that law enforcement authorities wouldn't be held accountable for wrongly prosecuting him. Gu says he was awarded some compensation for his time in jail, but he refused the money because it was a tiny sum compared to his assets, which he wants back.
For my company shares and 1,300 acres of land, I want $6.8 billion. It's okay if they only give me a few $100 million, but not giving me a penny would be going too far.
China's Economic Management Agency, the National Development and Reform Commission, did not respond to questions from NPR for this report. Gu notes that China's parliament considered a new law this month that would protect private businesses from officials who try to take their money.
If this private enterprise promotion law is passed, I may get some money back. If not, then the law would be useless.
As it turned out, though, the law failed to pass this session of parliament.
Okay, Anthony Kuhn, given that, given everything that you told us about the history here, what are the chances that these policy changes can get more out of private industry and help China's economy?
Well, Professor Huang Yasheng says that China's government is promising to protect entrepreneurs, but it doesn't appear that it's going to be taking any major steps to strengthen the rule of law right away. He also says that China has previously succeeded several times in encouraging private enterprise and boosting the economy. But this time, it's going to be harder than in past, when he says,
China had a huge upward potential to grow. In many ways, China had this pent-up entrepreneurship waiting to be unleashed into the economy. The situation today is entirely different.
So today, the low-hanging fruit of easy economic gains have already been picked. External demand for Chinese exports has slumped, and the country is now saddled with a lot of overcapacity and heavy debt. So, as Professor Huang points out, whether Chinese decide to go into business or invest is not just about government policy. It's also about the overall economic situation and whether people think they can make money in it. And that situation is far less favorable now than the last time the government tried to reassure entrepreneurs in 2018.
You know, Anthony, listening to this story, another thing that occurs to me is that in China, when you build up a fortune, that may not come with any political power.
That's correct. The difference between the leaders and their tech CEOs is very different. Although you see them in public, there seem to be similarities. The entrepreneur Gu Chujun told me that unlike their U.S. counterparts, Chinese entrepreneurs really have no chance of getting any political power. And so when he looks at Elon Musk, for example, running the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, he says that would just be unthinkable in China.
Anthony, thanks for the insights. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Steve.
That's NPR's Anthony Kuhn. He is with us here in Beijing, China, where we're reporting this week. And I just want to note there's about a 12-hour time difference between Beijing and the east coast of the United States. So it's morning where you are. It is the evening here. We'll be ordering food soon. Maybe Chinese. This is NPR News.
Young kids with disabilities often have to wait months for services. Medicaid can help those families get therapy, but the program is threatened. Next time on Here and Now.
The NPR app cuts through the noise, bringing you local, national, and global coverage. No paywalls, no profits, no nonsense. Download it in your app store today.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep reporting from Beijing, China, a leading country for artificial intelligence, where we saw a robot in our hotel. It vaguely resembles R2-D2 in a tuxedo. It takes the elevator and delivers food to rooms when guests order out. Naturally, we ordered out, but the food didn't arrive. The hotel blames human error. We failed to open the door for the robot, which took the order back downstairs. Robots have arrived, but we finally brought dinner up by hand. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station
and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Large protests have erupted in Turkey after the arrest of the mayor of Istanbul. Critics say the corruption charges are politically motivated, designed to remove a rival to longtime President Recep Tayyip Erdogan before the next election. Joining us now with the latest from Turkey is reporter Duri Buskaran. Duri, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so a court issued its arrest order on Sunday, but the mayor was initially detained last week. Can you walk us through how we got here?
Sure. Starting Wednesday, Mayor Ekrem İmamoğlu was in the equivalent of pre-trial detention. Prosecutors alleged that he was the ringleader of this massive conspiracy at City Hall to embezzle money and steal private information from citizens. There's also a separate case accusing him of links to Kurdish militants. He denied all of these charges at a hearing early on Sunday, but a judge ruled that İmamoğlu must spend the remainder of his trial in jail. He's incarcerated alongside about 50 other defendants, many of them former aides and municipal employees.
And this has inspired these large protests. I understand some of the biggest protests Turkey has seen in more than a decade. Say more about what's fueling these protests, getting people to come out into the street, and what you're hearing when you talk to people.
There's this anger that's been building. President Erdogan has consolidated all powers of the state under him over the past decade, and I think that anger is finally coming out. I mean, here's a clip from last night. So these protesters are chanting Hak, Hukuk, Adalet, rights, law, justice. Many say they're not here for İmamoğlu, they're here because it's a make or break moment for Turkish democracy. And police aren't outright blocking demonstrations, but they're using tear gas, plastic bullets, and even beating protesters to disperse them in some areas. They've also arrested journalists in house raids for being present at the protests, which are banned right now. The Interior Ministry says police officers have also been injured in these clashes, and Erdogan has accused the opposition of provoking the nation by calling for these protests to disturb the peace and polarize the people.
But, you know, the mayor's arrest came just days before his party was set to nominate him as their presidential candidate, and that would set him up to face Erdogan in 2028. And I take it his party says that this is related.
They do, although the administration denies this. And on Sunday, this was his party's first presidential primary in recent memory. After İmamoğlu's arrest, the party decided to open up voting to everyone, so even people who weren't registered opposition party members. All over the country yesterday, you had these incredibly long lines, even in conservative districts that usually go for Erdogan, and people were just dropping ballot after ballot into these solidarity voting boxes. At least 13 million people cast ballots this way yesterday, and for the formal primary, the turnout rate was like 94% for party members. So many analysts believe Erdogan will call for early elections, which would allow him to bypass term limits before 2028.
So would the mayor İmamoğlu even be able to run?
You can't run for office with a criminal conviction in Turkey, and İmamoğlu has been chased by these lawsuits since he took office as mayor in 2019. That said, there's another big figure in Turkish politics who is briefly imprisoned as a mayor, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. So here's the big question. Is İmamoğlu following in Erdogan's footsteps, or 22 years later, are Turkey's basic tenets of democracy so worn down that the crackdown will win?
That is reporter Duri Buskaran in Istanbul, Turkey. Duri, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Organizers for San Francisco Pride say several corporate sponsors have pulled out, and that leaves one of the biggest parades of its kind in the world short on funds. KQED's Carlos Cabrera Lomeli reports it's not the only Pride event with less corporate support.
Suzanne Ford grew up in Kentucky during the 70s and remembers watching San Francisco's first Pride parades on TV.
It was like a dream. It was somewhere out there in the world where people could really be who they were and that everyone celebrated, and it looked joyous to me.
Ford is now the executive director of San Francisco Pride.
It's a miracle that for $3.2 million we put on an event that had over a million people.
It's funded mostly through corporate sponsorships, but Ford says that earlier this month, longtime sponsors pulled out. That includes Comcast and Anheuser-Busch, who didn't respond to requests for comment, and the drink company, Diageo, which said in an email statement that there had been some changes to their sponsorship budget, but added that they're still sponsoring a smaller Pride event in Long Beach.
This isn't just budget constraints that we're dealing with.
That's Ike Silver. He's an assistant professor of marketing at the University of Southern California. He looks at how companies get involved in social issues. And while he says that companies may be giving less in an uncertain economy,
we're also dealing with very real economic risks associated with continuing to be involved with causes that are controversial or that might provoke the ire of the president, these sorts of things.
He says corporate support of Pride and other LGBTQ spaces expanded after the Supreme Court recognized same-sex marriage in 2015. But he points out that since then, there's been more polarization on LGBTQ causes like transgender people in sports and the military. Houston Pride also confirmed that they're seeing some companies give less. And while New York City Pride says donors are maintaining financial support, some are scaling back branding for their floats. But some queer organizers say it's time for Pride to stop being so dependent on corporate sponsorship.
Pride was founded by riots and rallies and bricks and blood and by the labor of Black and brown trans women.
Justice Thatt is part of San Francisco's Harvey Milk LGBTQ Democratic Club, which has called for companies that have ended their diversity initiatives to be banned from Pride.
We have fought too long and too hard to be lamenting that a couple of companies with billionaire interests don't want to pay for our party.
San Francisco Pride organizers say that since they first announced that corporations were stepping back, individual donations have gone up. For NPR News, I'm Carlos Cabrera Lomeli in San Francisco.
Teens and young adults are watching a lot of TikToks about mental health, especially about ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. But just how reliable are these videos? NPR's Will Stone looked for an answer.
Spend enough time with hashtag ADHD on TikTok, and how you shop for groceries, the way you walk, the music you like, the state of your kitchen, any of this could mean you have ADHD. The videos can be funny and relatable. Vasilia Karasava says there's a reason they rack up millions of views.
Going through a list of diagnostic symptoms, I imagine that's kind of boring for people to watch.
But the claims aren't often backed up by credible sources and can overstate or vastly simplify a complex diagnosis.
A lot of them lacked in nuance and didn't have disclaimers that some of the things that they were describing would also apply to people without ADHD.
Or that they don't apply to everyone with ADHD. This is what Karasava, who's at the University of British Columbia, concluded in a new study looking at the top 100 TikTok videos on ADHD. Just under half accurately reflected the clinical criteria. The study also had hundreds of college students watch some of the content. More time spent on TikTok meant people were more likely to recommend these videos, whether or not they were accurate. It also led them to vastly overestimate the prevalence of ADHD, which is about 5% in Canada and around 6% in the U.S. And Karasava says it shaped how people viewed these symptoms.
They thought they were worse and harder to cope with.
The study expands on earlier research showing TikTok has lots of misleading content on ADHD.
Actually, it's a little surprising that 50% is scientifically accurate. I would have guessed that the number would have been lower.
Kevin Anchel is a psychologist at Syracuse University. He and others who focus on ADHD in young adults encounter the downstream effects of this regularly.
they already have a self-diagnosis that's been made on this content, and they arrive at our office telling us they have ADHD, and in fact, quite often now they're telling us the type and the dose of medication they want to treat this.
One concern, he says, is people end up pursuing unnecessary treatment. Stimulant misuse is a problem on college campuses. In fact, the new study also found content creators were often selling something. But Anshul sees positives, too.
I don't want this to come across as I'm belittling people. I am not. TikTok, I think, is really helping to fill a void here.
Maggie Sibley agrees. She's a psychologist at the University of Washington and says, yes, some are getting the wrong idea from TikTok, but
there are probably just as many people who are getting a first-time diagnosis because finally they've recognized their ADHD in themselves because of the folks they've been seeing online.
She says the fact is ADHD is a spectrum. The average American may have two or three traits. This doesn't mean they have the diagnosis, even though by some accounts, one in four adults in the U.S. suspect they do.
ADHD isn't a temporary response to your environment. It's a lifelong, largely genetic condition.
TikTok content may also blur the line between ADHD and symptoms that actually point to things like anxiety, depression, trauma. A problem is the U.S. doesn't have guidelines for adult ADHD. Sibley is helping develop those.
I love all of the interesting novel ideas that are coming off of Reddit and TikTok about possible new directions for ADHD symptoms.
Sibley believes researchers like her should listen with an open mind and then rigorously study what holds up. Will Stone, NPR News.
Support for NPR health coverage comes from Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19. The CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. And from Procter & Gamble, maker of Nervive. Nervive Nerve Relief is designed to reduce occasional nerve aches, weakness, and discomfort in hands or feet due to aging. Learn more at nervivehealth.com.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Mama, why, up your eyes.